I don't know if you've actually ever thought about this, but what idols did you formerly worship, or are you currently now still tempted to worship? And for those of you who are really spiritual and might be thinking, oh, I'm not an idolater, I'm sorry to be the one to inform you that you're deceived and you're calling God a liar. Now, for me, as an example, it's quite easy that the main God I used to worship is pleasure, or I was a pleasure worshipper and still tempted down those lines. And for those that aren't aware, pleasure worship is the doctrine, basic doctrines of pleasure worship basically enhance your own experience of pleasure in this world and minimise pain and suffering. And because I'm more important than you, if you have to suffer a bit to enhance my experience of pleasure, well, that's too bad for you. And one of the sort of main manifestations of pleasure worship, of course, is selfishness. Because I'm more important than you, and my positive experience of this world is more important than the negative effect that may have on you. And that's pretty much sums up our culture in a way, doesn't it? That's one of the primary gods that we see worshipped among our own fellow Australians. And what we see today is that an examination of this issue, I guess, of the human heart's propensity to worship idols, even when they have the revelation of the true and living God. Because idolatry is not just blocks of wood and bowing down or false ideologies of the world. It's trying to reshape the true and living God into something that is not. And of course, this was one of Israel's primary problems. So to help think this through a bit more clearly, let's recall some key aspects of the situation these passages address. So Isaiah chapters 1 to 39 describe the danger the southern kingdom of Israel, largely entailing Judah and Jerusalem, is under by the Assyrians, who have destroyed the northern kingdom of Israel, sometimes described as the 10 tribes. But the southern kingdom has failed to heed and respond rightly to the preaching of Isaiah. And now in chapters 40 to 55, find themselves in exile in Babylon. God's actually physically removed them from the land, destroyed the temple. And this has caused a massive crisis of faith for the people, because they are away from the land promised to Abraham. The Davidic kingdom looks decimated beyond recovery, and the temple where Yahweh dwells with his covenant people, not one stone is left on another. And the popular interpretation of how this happened is that the gods of Babylon are more powerful and wise than Yahweh, the God of Jacob. So you put yourself in that situation, otherwise how could it happen? That's the most intellectual, reasonable, rational explanation. But the argument of Isaiah is that actually Yahweh did it. God did it. And he did it with definite purpose. And a key aspect of this argument is that the first 39 chapters of Isaiah actually predict that this is what would happen if Israel kept down the course of idolatry that they were pursuing. And the fact that that Israel in exile cannot see this is part of the ongoing problem of Israel being a blind and deaf servant who cannot grasp God's bigger purposes. And because Yahweh does have bigger purposes, even the exile is not the end of the story. And what Isaiah goes on to say and predict is that, in fact, he will restore Israel to the land. And the way that this is described in Isaiah is as a glorious second exodus. So the first exodus was from Egypt to the land of Israel. What's going to occur now is a glorious new second exodus. So Yahweh has promised just that he's about to do a new thing in the previous chapter, which includes at least this second exodus, this return to the promised land. Because he said all along that this exile was a temporary discipline before a remnant would be replanted back in the land. And we saw last time, I think Bruce preached that for us, that it's expressed in these terms. It says, "But now thus says the Lord who created you, O Jacob who formed you, O Israel, fear not, for I have redeemed you. I have called you by name, you are mine. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. Through the rivers, they shall not overwhelm you. And when you walk through the fire, you shall not be burned, and the flame shall not consume you. For I am the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, your Saviour." But what we have in now, immediately following this promise of a glorious second exodus, is Israel's response to this promise, which is expressed in terms of their continual or habitual response to Yahweh, their God. And so look at verse 22, which literally says, "It was not me you called on, O Jacob, and you are wearied with me, O Israel." It's pretty damning, isn't it? To be tired of Yahweh. To be tired of God. So we'll call on other gods or an imagined version of God. They seem to work. Clearly Yahweh is not effective because look at our circumstances. So they weren't even calling on God or seeking him, but yet they became weary of him. Or tired of him. See, some people are like that in our culture, aren't they? They don't believe in God or seek him, but when things go pear-shaped in their life, it's his fault. But how can it be if he's not there? But it gets much worse, verses 23 to 24. See, God in exile, in Israel in Babylonian exile, God hasn't required sacrifices in the way that was required when the temple was standing and functioning in the way that it was intended. And so there's two words here that there's a bit of a wordplay happening, the two words wearied and burdened. And it goes like this. Israel were wearied with God, tired of God, even though God never wearied them with excessive religious requirements or burdened them with offerings. But they burdened him with their sins and wearied him with their iniquities. So the religious formalities have changed according to their new situation in Babylonian exile, but Israel have not changed. And this hints at what starts becoming a very big theme in these chapters, which is that the exile hasn't changed a thing. That the underlying problem is still the same, which is the people. These people who are wearied of Yahweh. But even in the face of this, this is highly offensive. And even in the face of this, look at how Yahweh reacts and continues to deal with Israel, particularly verse 25. In spite of all this, what does he do? He continues to forgive or blot out their sins. He does not hold their sins against them. in the sense of some sort of final condemnation. But he does exercise discipline over them according to the covenant he made with them. And he does all this for the sake of his own name or reputation. If God treated Israel to the full extent of their sin, they wouldn't continue to exist, which would go against his clearly stated promises of what he will achieve through them. But what he wants Israel to do is to interpret their situation rightly, to put God and his word back on the table and reassess their circumstances accordingly. See, they have not rightly listened to the first 39 chapters of Isaiah, which makes the reason for their exile abundantly clear. As God reminds them here, your sins are a wearisome burden to me. And verse 27, this has always been the case. This is not some new situation. Look what God says. Jacob himself was the same. And this is important because it's pointing out that there's something fundamentally wrong. Israel's current preference for idolatry and sin is not an anomaly. It's not created by their new circumstances. There is something fundamentally wrong. And it's been the pattern since Jacob, and even before him with Abraham for that matter. So already Yahweh's plan to bring about this second exodus from Babylon, from Babylonian exile back to the promised land, is meeting with unbelief and hard-heartedness. And again, we have this problem that the exile didn't fundamentally change anything. Already a hint here that something far more radical is going to be required to bring about this change that's needed. See, Israel physically relocating back to Jerusalem isn't going to be enough by itself, is it? Because it's the same old Israel. So chapter 44, verses 1 to 5, what we see is that Yahweh will do this anyway in spite of Israel. So look at 44 verse 1, and if you can multitask, contrast that with 43:22. On the one hand, Israel didn't call on Yahweh. It wasn't him they were seeking. But now they're told, 44:1, to hear. They were wearied with God, or tired of God. But from God's perspective, chapter 44, verses 1 and 2, they are still his chosen and still his servant. Obviously a failed servant, which is why we need the ideal servant. But Jacob is still God's servant here nevertheless. So verses 1 and 2 are really extraordinary, aren't they? In the face of all this, God says, I made you. Fear not, you are my servant, Jacob. You are my chosen. And even more extraordinarily here, this is hard to grasp. I had to check this with 3 or 4 commentators. But the word Jeshurun there means my upright one. And you've got to think, how is that possible here? Jacob, my upright one. What this reminds us of, doesn't it, is that the standing of Israel was never something about them, but about Yahweh conferring on them a status that they don't deserve. In this situation, not only does Israel continue to be described as Yahweh's servant, albeit a failed one, but they are also described as his upright one. Which makes no sense if we understand righteousness to be awarded according to the nature of Israel themselves. It reminds us of one of those great important ideas grounded in grace, that if people are to be right with God, it won't be by some system of merit or deservedness. Even in the Old Testament, that was never the case. It's always been the case that right standing comes through election and grace and being credited with an alien righteousness, a righteousness that does not naturally belong to us, but's been given or credited. And of course, not far away in this part of Isaiah, which we'll see unfold more clearly as we go, is the ideal servant is always in the background here. We've been introduced to him in chapter 42, and he will be fundamental to how this unfolds. And so God continues to restate his purposes for Israel, which will be achieved, verses 3 to 5. Somehow through Israel, God will still achieve his plan, not just to save his people, but to restore the created order. See, somehow Israel being restored again to the land is a pattern of a much greater restoration. Some of this language here belongs to the original creation, where God's Spirit was actively making a habitable world. But his Spirit will specifically be given to people, but not just ethnic Israelites. But people will come from everywhere to be named by the name of Jacob. God will keep his promises to Abraham, to make his descendants more numerous than the sand on the sea. And if we remember carefully to the original promises to Abraham, we'll know that these were a specific expression of God's original blessing on Adam and Eve in creation. That God's goal through Israel is not just their salvation, but cosmic restoration. And important in this context is that idols cannot do this. Idols of human imagination or ideologies of human construction cannot restore creation and establish order. We live in a generation that's been around on this world now for a long time. We've had at least 6,000 years of human history, and no human ideology has restored creation or created order. When are we going to say, actually, we can't do it? In our idolatry and sinfulness, it's beyond us. We need help. We need someone to do it for us. And again, remember the context. There are many arguments against idolatry in this part of Isaiah because Israel have been deceived into interpreting their circumstances according to the popular view of the time, the rational, intelligent, obvious view, apparently, that the Babylonian gods are more powerful and wise than Yahweh. That's why this has happened. Idols are being given credit for causing the tumultuous political events surrounding the circumstances of Israel, but idols didn't do it at all. Look at verses 6 to 8. God is emphasizing that he is still Yahweh, the God of the original Exodus. He alone can determine the future, and there exists nothing that can stop him achieving that. There is no other rock. And so verse 8, specifically in this case, that means Israel must continue to exist, to bear witness, concerning Yahweh. The political events of the time were Yahweh's instrument to achieve his ongoing purposes. There is no other God. That's why now in verses 9 to 20, there is this satirical or sarcastic mockery of idolatry and idols and the people who make and worship them. This is possibly one of the most sarcastic parts of the Bible. See, we get the picture, don't we? We read it before. Someone chops down a tree, which was nourished by the rain, which they may have planted 20 years before. And what they do is they chop it down, they cut that in half. They use half of it to light a fire and keep warm and cook their food. Then he makes some image out of the other half, sort of nails it down so it doesn't fall over, and then bows down to it and says, "Save me. Help me." And the satire of this is such that we could imagine that if he left his God too close to the fire, he might get burned. He might singe his deity. See, we get the picture, don't we? How stupid is it to bow down to something that we fabricate in our minds and then make with our hands? Part of the satire of this passage is how much care and effort the tradesman goes to make his idol. How much, or to use modern lingo, how much investment he puts into it. And let's be honest, a lot of investment goes into idolatry. In fact, the amount that is invested in lies and falsehood and idols is staggering. People literally stake their lives on their idols, on their own interpretation of this world. And our idols can do nothing anyway. See, all more money gets us in the end is a more expensive coffin. And verses 18 to 20 are quite important because it really nails this issue of idolatry and brings it down to what it is, which is a problem with the human heart. Why do we do this? And especially verse 20 captures the sinister nature of idolatry. We become so deceived by what we want to believe that we can't see otherwise. We cannot see or won't see that to build our life on idolatry is fundamentally to live a lie. To live our whole life on a false premise. And this passage contributes to the important idea in the Bible that we become according to what we worship or honour. And this is what this passage doesn't hold back in saying. People who make worthless idols become worthless like them. We become what we worship. Now, even though it doesn't manifest in the same way, our culture has this same problem of immersion in idolatry. What we do is give divine status to material things, such as pleasure, money, work, human relationships. These are all great things, but they can never successfully function as God. Whenever we ascribe some ultimate value to these things, we are functionally idolaters. We are fabricating a world that's not real. You know, we become our own Hollywood, constructing a fake reality, a make-believe world which cannot stand when the storms of reality come, when the light of truth shines, And so again, verses 21 to 23 brings us back to the reality that Yahweh alone is the true God and his purposes cannot be stopped, because he supervised the exile to Babylon that his purposes might continue on in the right manner. So there's this tension in Isaiah continues. Jacob or Israel remain Yahweh's servant because his purposes cannot be thwarted, and he is faithful to those purposes. But Israel are a far less than ideal servant. They are a failed servant. And so we need some ideal version of Israel. But even at the time of Jesus, this whole situation hadn't really changed at all. When Jesus came, he had to confront these same problems. And the passage, if you want to quickly look at that again, look to Mark chapter 2, verses 21 to 22. We can see a particular way that Jesus addressed this. Because what Jesus encountered is that Jerusalem was no different, that the real problem of the idolatrous human heart has not been identified, to the extent that when Jesus himself comes, he's not recognised. But we can see in these verses that when he came, the extraordinary nature of his being and purposes was just not grasped. Because the two verses we want to just quickly focus on are where Jesus says you can't put new wine into old wineskins, or put a new patch on old clothing, because it will tear it apart when it shrinks. And the problem here is that the religious leaders tried to contain Jesus in the structures of the old covenant. But you can't do that because he blows them apart. The old covenant is essential for us to understand and interpret Jesus, but you can't restrict him by it. The categories of the Exodus and old covenant, such as sacrifice, God dwelling with his people, the need for a priest to mediate between sinners and God and so on, these are essential things. The old covenant was never designed, though, to contain Jesus, but to interpret him. Let me give you an example. The stormwater system in Borbor Shire was never designed for our high-density living. The designers of the existing stormwater system never envisaged a day when blocks of land would become so small and houses so big. So when you Google map Borbor Shire now, we live in a situation where not just 20% of the Shire is covered in house roofs, but 60%. Suddenly you have to get rid of so much more water than the old system was designed for. So what you could do is rip out the old smaller pipes and put in much bigger ones. But that is an enormous and costly job. So what they do instead is try to control the extra flow so that they can continue making use of the existing infrastructure. So, for example, one way they do that is make people install a rainwater tank that acts as like a temporary reservoir that holds all the water and releases it through a very small pipe. So it takes pressure off the existing system so that it can still function reasonably effectively. What Jesus is saying here is you cannot apply that principle to him. You cannot contain Jesus inside the structures of Judaism. Now, don't mishear me. I'm not saying we don't need to understand the Old Testament and its categories. We desperately need to know the Old Testament better because we can't interpret Jesus properly if we don't. But the Old Testament provides the context for understanding Jesus. But that is different from the Pharisees who wanted to restrict Jesus inside the structures of Judaism. But he expands the categories of the Old Testament so far that you can't contain him inside it. See, for people who want to conform Jesus inside existing religious structures, you can't do it. You will never understand Jesus properly. He didn't come to tweak a system that was essentially effective. He came to revolutionize what was the problem all along, which is the human heart. More laws won't help us. New Exodus salvation is a radical reapplication of Exodus principles to the deeply ingrained and sinister corruption that is the human soul. See, idolatry is our main problem because it prevents us from seeing the glory of Yahweh and his new Exodus salvation in Jesus Christ. Idols cannot bring about anything, let alone the radical redemption that humanity require. And if we cannot and should not force Jesus into the limitations of Judaism, we certainly cannot force him into our idolatries and expect to hold him there. See, we're so committed to idolatry that we always tend to diminish Jesus. We always make him less important than he is. See, we are the problem. We weary God with our sins and burden him with our iniquities and then complain that we don't live in a better world. See, our hearts are idol-making factories, and then we complain that God is against us because he leaves us to our idols. See, because in this passage, idols and idolatrous human ideologies are a key reason why we cannot see Jesus for who he is, it's important, isn't it, that we can self-examine and identify our own idols. Tim Keller, at the end of his book Counterfeit Gods, gives some basic ways to help analyse ourselves in this regard. Firstly, he makes the point that the main difference, say, between sorrow and despair is that sorrow is often caused by losing one good thing among other good things, but despair can be caused by losing an ultimate thing. What causes you to despair and why? That's one way to test our idolatry. Some other tests might be, what would you miss the most if you lost it? And why? Is it an idol or just something good that we value in proper perspective? What do you do in your spare time or solitude? What does your mind wander to or love? What does your diary say about what matters? What does your credit card statement say about what you love? Which parts of Jesus' teaching don't you like and why? What causes you the most anxiety or anger? Is it because you love something too much? Are we intimidated so much by our culture that we're too scared to say anything? See, we need to keep in mind, don't we, that idols look good, they promise much, and they don't present as bad. They present as attractive, even sophisticated and intellectual. So let's finish with this example. Jesus says to us, whoever loves his own life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will save it. Idols will never tell you that. But in the end, that is largely because they can't save us either.